Okay, let's get right into it. Forget everything you thought you knew about the brain being just a bunch of individual parts doing their own thing. Today, we're taking a deep dive into something much more dynamic: brain networks. These are incredible collections of interconnected brain regions that work together like teams.
Exactly. It's a real fundamental shift in how we understand the brain. The real action, happens when these different areas coordinate and
Not
communicate.
just in isolation.
Not just in isolation, yeah.
Our mission in this deep dive is to really unpack what these networks are, explore how researchers even go about seeing these, well, invisible connections, and then dive into some of the most well-known networks that essentially run the show inside your head, governing everything from your most, like, absent-minded moments to your sharpest focus and deepest emotions. We've got a stack of sources here to guide us.
Think of this as understanding the brain's true operating system. It's where you start to get those surprising aha moments about why your mind behaves the way it does,
Yeah.
why you get lost in thought, maybe, or why you can suddenly snap to attention.
So let's start with the big picture then. When we say brain networks, what are we actually talking about, and how do we even know they exist as, well, networks?
Great place to start. At the simplest level, a brain network is just a group of distinct brain regions that are functionally linked. And crucially, you won't find neat lines on an anatomical map saying this is network A. They're defined much more by their activity, their connection patterns.
So it's not just about being next-door neighbors in the brain structurally.
Not at all. Regions in a network might actually be quite far apart physically, but they show correlated activity over time. This is what researchers call functional connectivity.
Okay.
It's kind of like noticing that every time one specific light blinks on in a large building, another specific light blinks on simultaneously way across the building,
Right.
even if you can't see the wire connecting them. That synchronized activity, it suggests they're talking to each other or reacting to the same signal.
And how do we see those lights blinking together in the brain? I mean, obviously not literally lights, but.
Right. Well, that's where neuroimaging comes in. Techniques like fMRI that measures blood flow changes related to neural activity and EEG, which measures electrical activity, they allow researchers to track when different brain regions are active. So by analyzing these patterns across the whole brain, they can spot which regions are consistently lighting up together.
Okay, so functional connectivity tells us who's talking at the same time, but the sources also talk about the brain's physical wiring diagram. That sounds different.
It is different. Yeah, that's structural connectivity. This is the brain's literal infrastructure, the
Yeah.
physical connections, the bundles of axons, the white matter tracts that link different regions together.
Ah, so like the actual physical phone lines connecting those distant lights you mentioned.
Precisely. It's the underlying structure that, well, enables the functional communication to happen in the first place. This is usually studied using something called diffusion tensor imaging, or DTI. It's a special type of MRI that tracks how water diffuses along these nerve fibers so it can map out their pathways.
I see.
Understanding these structural connections gives us insight into the potential routes information can travel. And, when these physical wires are damaged, maybe through injury or disease, it can disrupt the communication flow that can lead to cognitive or motor issues.
Okay, so we're looking at both the conversations happening, the functional side, and the physical lines enabling them, the structural side. What about the overall layout? The sources mention network topology. It sounds a bit like map making.
It kind of is. It brings in concepts from graph theory, which is basically a way to analyze complex systems of nodes and connections. In the brain, the regions are the nodes, right? And the connections, whether functional or structural, are the edges. Topology analysis looks at the organization like, how dense are the connections? Are there central hubs that are highly connected to many other areas? How efficiently can information theoretically flow through this network?
So it's like mapping a city's road system, finding the main highways, the key intersections, that sort of
That's a
thing.
great analogy, exactly. Mapping the brain's topology reveals how it's organized for efficient information processing. Identifying those hubs regions like the posterior cingulate cortex or parts of the prefrontal cortex is really crucial because they seem to act like central traffic controllers.
Right.
And their organization, how efficient it is linked to things like how resilient the brain is or how easily it can adapt.
And what about the idea that this isn't static? I think the source has called it dynamic networks. It's not a fixed map.
No, definitely not. And this is a critical and really evolving area of research. The brain's networks aren't fixed blueprints at all. They're patterns of activity. Even the strength of the connections between regions can change, not just over years as you learn, but really moment by moment. Depends on what you're doing, your state of mind.
Like the city's traffic flow changing throughout the day. Rush hour versus midnight.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. These rapid reconfigurations are key to flexible cognition. You know, how you switch between tasks, learn new things, or even experience different states of consciousness. It also helps us understand how the brain tries to reorganize itself after, say, an injury or during disease. So yeah, we're not just studying a static map. We're studying a constantly shifting landscape of connections.
It sounds incredibly complex.
Yeah.
But okay, using these tools, researchers have identified some specific networks that seem to show up consistently. They seem to have dedicated roles. Let's dive into a few of the most fascinating ones.
Absolutely. There are several well-characterized networks. And yeah, each seems to play a pretty vital role in our mental lives.
And maybe the most talked about, and perhaps kind of counterintuitively named, is the default mode network, the DMN. Why default mode? Seems like it should be doing nothing.
Right. It's called the default mode because, well, it's the network that becomes most active when you're not actively engaged in some demanding task that requires focusing on the outside world. It's like your brain's go-to state when you're just resting, maybe daydreaming, letting your mind wander, or simply letting your thoughts drift.
So when I'm zoning out, waiting in line, or maybe staring out the window, the DMN is probably buzzing.
Very likely, yeah. Key regions involved include areas in the medial prefrontal cortex, the posterior cingulate cortex, the pecuneus, and the angular gyrus. And these aren't random spots. They're often central hubs, frequently linked to self-related processing. And the DMN does, well, it does a lot.
Like what?
It's deeply involved in self-referential thought. So thinking about yourself, your past, your future, your identity, your beliefs. It's kind of the engine of that constant inner monologue many of us have.
Okay, that explains a lot.
It also plays roles in processing emotions tied to your personal experiences and something called theory of mind, which is basically understanding other people's perspectives and intentions. That's crucial for empathy, for social interaction, and mind wandering itself, which, yeah, can be distracting sometimes.
Definitely.
But it's also linked to creativity, maybe stumbling onto solutions and consolidating memories, making sense of things.
So it's anything but idle then. It's busy constructing our sense of self, navigating social landscapes, maybe even making sense of our lives.
Precisely. And here's a really key interaction. When you do switch to a task that needs focused attention, like, say, reading something complex or solving a math problem,
right,
the DMN typically quiets down. It sort of switches places with other networks designed for that focus. When the DMN doesn't deactivate properly during tasks, that can interfere with your concentration.
And we know that when this network isn't functioning optimally, it's implicated in conditions like depression, right? Where rumination can be excessive, or Alzheimer's, where that sense of self and memory are so affected.
That's right, which makes it a really significant area of clinical research, obviously.
Now, one particularly intriguing thread in the sources, and one that sparked a lot of recent research, is this interaction between psychedelics and the DMN. This feels like it gets right to the edge of what we understand about consciousness itself.
It's truly fascinating stuff. Research is showing that substances like psilocybin, you know, from magic mushrooms or LSD, they seem to have a pretty profound impact on DMN activity. Studies using fMRI consistently report a reduction in the activity within the DMN while participants are under the influence.
So the network associated with the me, the inner narrative, it quietens down.
That's the observation, yeah. And what's really interesting is that this reduction in DMN activity is often correlated with the subjective experience that users describe as ego dissolution.
Ego dissolution.
Yeah, a fading or blurring of the sense of self, a feeling of being less separate from the external world, sometimes even a sense of unity or interconnectedness with everything.
That makes a kind of intuitive sense. If the network that helps construct me is less active, the feeling of me might lessen too.
Exactly what researchers are thinking. And at the same time, the sources highlight that these substances can lead to increased global connectivity.
Meaning?
Meaning more communication happening between different networks that normally don't interact all that strongly. It's like the barriers between networks become more permeable. This increased crosstalk across the brain might contribute to the altered perceptions, the novel insights people often report.
And even brainwave patterns change, like with EEG.
Yes, EEG studies show shifts too. Often a decrease in alpha waves, which are typical of normal waking rest, and sometimes increases in delta and gamma waves, which are associated with very different states from deep sleep or deep meditation to maybe intense focus.
And users often report these experiences as profound or transformative, sometimes even comparing them to descriptions of like enlightenment found in various traditions.
That's according to subjective reports, yes. The sources certainly describe these experiences as often being deeply personal, sometimes having lasting positive effects reported by the individuals.
Now, this is where it gets really exciting, but also where the sources include some essential words of caution. It's definitely not a simple story, is it?
Absolutely vital for perspective here. The sources are very clear. While the correlation between DMN changes and these subjective experiences is compelling, correlation is not causation.
Right, the classic trap.
Exactly. We need a lot more research to understand if the DMN changes are actually the cause of the experience or maybe just a brain state that happens to accompany it. A byproduct, perhaps.
And defining something like enlightenment scientifically is...
Tricky. Right. Very tricky. Whether psychedelics genuinely lead to lasting enlightenment in some traditional spiritual sense is really a philosophical and subjective question. It's not something neuroscience has settled, or maybe even can settle easily. Also, individual differences are just enormous. The effects vary massively based on the person, the dose, and critically, the set and setting idea.
Yeah.
Not everyone has a mystical or posit experience. Some can be very challenging, even frightening.
And we don't fully know the long-term effects yet.
Precisely. Much more research is needed to understand the lasting impacts, both potentially positive and negative. So while this area is opening up some really fascinating doors into consciousness and the brain's potential states, it absolutely has to be approached with scientific rigor and, frankly, a healthy dose of caution.
Okay, so we have the DMN handling our inner world, our rest state.
Mm.
What about when you need to ignore all that internal chatter and focus intensely on a complex task?
Right.
That requires a different network, right?
Mm-hmm.
A different team takes over.
Absolutely. That's largely the domain of the central executive network, often called the CEN, or sometimes you'll see it referred to as the frontoparietal network, the FPN. If the DMN is the network for internal reflection, the CEN is more like your brain's active command center for conscious, effortful control.
Right, the network that's really working hard when I'm trying to plan something complicated or solve a tough problem, maybe learn something new.
Exactly right. It includes crucial areas like the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, that's DLPFC, and the posterior parietal cortex, PPC. This is the network you engage for things like working memory, you know, holding and manipulating information in your mind temporarily, attentional control, directing your focus where you want it, and suppressing distractions, decision-making, planning, problem-solving, and cognitive flexibility, being able to switch strategies when something isn't working.
Yeah, these are the processes that feel most effortful, most like deliberate thinking.
They often are. The CEN becomes highly active when a task demands that kind of cognitive control. And interestingly, it often works in opposition to the DMN. As CEN activity goes up, DMN activity tends to go down.
The seesaw effect.
Kind of, yeah. And it also interacts really closely with another network, the salience network, which helps decide when to activate the CEN in the first place.
And when the CEN isn't working efficiently, what happens then?
Well, dysfunction in the CEN is strongly linked to disorders involving difficulties with those executive functions we just listed. Things like ADHD, schizophrenia, and conditions resulting from traumatic brain injury often show disruptions here. It's really vital for goal-directed behavior.
You mentioned the salience network mediating the switch between the DMN and the CEN. What exactly is the salience network's role? Sounds important.
Oh, it's crucial. The salience network, or SN, is like the brain's internal alert system, maybe a gatekeeper. Its primary job is to monitor both what's happening inside your body, your internal state, and what's happening in the external environment, and then identify what is salient, what's important or novel or potentially significant right now.
So it filters the endless stream of information coming in, constantly asking, does this matter? Should I pay attention?
Precisely that. It assesses the significance of incoming stimuli based on factors like, say, emotional relevance, novelty, or potential impact on you. Its key players are the anterior insula, which is really crucial for internal body awareness, like feeling your heartbeat and processing emotions, and the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, or DACC, which is involved in detecting conflicts or errors, like when something unexpected happens.
And it tells the other networks what to do, essentially.
Yeah.
It directs traffic between the DMN and CEN.
Yeah, that's a critical role. It's deeply involved in regulating that switch. So if the SN detects something significant while the DMN is active, maybe you're daydreaming and you suddenly hear your name called from across the room.
Yeah.
The SN signals for the DMN to deactivate and the CEN to become active, so you can shift your attention and respond appropriately. And conversely, once a demanding task is complete, the SN can signal the shift back to the DMN's default state.
It decides which team needs to be on the field at any given moment. Makes sense.
Exactly. And it's also involved in other things like emotional regulation, social cognition, even pain processing, because all of those involve detecting and responding to significant internal or external signals.
And problems here.
Dysfunction in the SN is implicated in conditions like anxiety disorders, where maybe seemingly neutral stimuli might be incorrectly flagged as highly salient or threatening, or schizophrenia, which can involve difficulties distinguishing internal thoughts from external reality, potentially related to faulty salience processing.
That interconnectedness makes so much sense. The networks aren't isolated. They're constantly managing each other. Speaking of managing, we need to cover attention more specifically. The sources note that attention itself involves two distinct networks working together.
Right. Attention isn't just one single process controlled by one area. It's really more of a partnership between two key systems that work together but have different jobs.
Okay, so first, there's the dorsal attention network, the DAN.
The DAN, yes. This one is responsible for what we call top-down attention, or goal-directed attention. This is the voluntary kind. It's the network you use when you consciously decide to focus on something specific, like you're searching for your keys on messy table, or you're trying to read a dense article, or even just maintaining vigilance during a really boring task.
Mm-hmm.
It helps you sustain your focus and actively filter out distractions based on what your current goals are. Key regions are in the frontal eye fields, FEF, and the intraparietal sulcus, IPS.
Though controlling where your focus is deliberately directed.
Yeah, exactly. Then there's the ventral attention network, or VAN. This is the counterpart. It's the bottom-up or stimulus-driven system, and this one is largely involuntary.
Yep.
The VAN is the network that kicks in when something unexpected or highly salient out in the world grabs your attention, interrupting whatever you were focusing on before.
Like a sudden loud noise or a flash of movement in your peripheral vision, something that just snags your attention.
Perfect examples. The VAN's main job is attentional reorienting, quickly shifting your focus to that new, potentially important stimulus. It involves areas like the temporoparietal junction, TPJ. So while the DAN is trying its best to keep you focused on your goals, the VAN is constantly scanning the environment, kind of like radar, for anything that might require a rapid shift and attention, a potential threat or opportunity.
So they work in a sort of dynamic balance, the DAN trying to hold steady, keep you on task, and the VAN ready to hijack your attention if something potentially urgent comes up.
Precisely. It's a really elegant, complementary interaction that allows us to, you know, stay focused when we need to, but also react quickly to unexpected events in a changing world.
Makes sense for survival.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And problems with this dynamic, this balance, are often seen in attentional disorders like ADHD, where managing that balance between maintaining focus and being easily distracted is a core challenge.
Okay. We've covered the networks for our inner world, for focused tasks, for filtering what's relevant, and for directing attention itself. What about the really fundamental drives and feelings that shape so much of our experience, emotions, and motivations?
Right. That brings us squarely into the territory of the limbic network. This is often considered the core of our emotional brain, though it's heavily interconnected, of course. It's essentially a collection of interconnected structures critical for processing emotions, forming emotional memories, and also driving motivations. This network is deeply rooted in survival instincts and plays a huge role in social behavior, too.
What are some of the main players in this limbic team?
Well, you have some really well-known structures, like the amygdala, often called the fear center. It's central to processing fear and anxiety, recognizing threats, and forming powerful emotional memories. Then there's the hippocampus, which is vital for forming new memories in general, but especially those tied to strong emotions. It's also involved in spatial navigation, interestingly. You've also got the thalamus, which acts as a major sensory relay station, kind of filtering incoming sensory information and giving priority to emotionally significant stimuli.
Okay.
And importantly, parts of the prefrontal cortex are also heavily involved, particularly in regulating emotions, sort of dampening or amplifying responses from other limbic areas, and integrating emotional information into our decision-making and impulse control.
So they're not just generating feelings in isolation, but linking them intricately to memory and influencing our choices and actions.
Exactly. They form a dynamic system. It allows us to experience a whole range of emotions, learn from emotionally charged situations, both good and bad, and hopefully respond appropriately. And again, this network doesn't operate in a vacuum. It heavily interacts with other networks we've talked about, like the DMN influencing our self-reflection with emotional tone and the CEN, integrating emotional information into conscious thought and planning.
And issues here are linked to a pretty wide range of conditions, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Dysfunction in the limbic system or its connections is implicated in many disorders like anxiety disorders, depression, PTSD, where emotional processing or regulation is clearly disrupted, and also in conditions like Alzheimer's disease, which often affects emotional memory alongside other cognitive functions.
Okay, one more major network area to cover. Finally, let's talk about what makes us want to do anything in the first place. The system that drives pleasure and motivation, the reward network.
Ah, yes, a fundamental network for, well, pretty much all animals, including us. It's really the engine behind motivation, behind pleasure seeking, and behind learning the behaviors that lead to positive outcomes. It's why you're driven to seek out food when you're hungry, or connect with other people, or pursue a goal that you find rewarding. It keeps us going.
What are the key components that make this crucial system work?
The core involves a pathway that starts in the ventral tegmental area, or VTA. It's deep in the midbrain, and it's a primary source of the neurotransmitter dopamine.
Dopamine, the feel-good chemical we hear so much about.
It's often called that, though its role is a bit more complex. It's heavily involved in signaling prediction errors or the salience of potential rewards, driving learning and motivation. But yes, it's central here. This dopamine is released from the VTA to a major target area, the nucleus accumbens, or NANAC, which is located in the forebrain.
So the VTA produces the dopamine, sends it to the NANAC, and the NANAC responds.
That's the basic pathway, yes.
Got it.
When you experience something rewarding, whether it's eating something delicious, receiving praise, achieving a goal, learning something new, the VTA releases dopamine into the NANAC. This activation is associated with the feeling of pleasure, sure, but crucially, it reinforces the behavior that led to the reward. It basically tells your brain, hey, that was good, do that again. Makes you more likely to repeat it.
And the prefrontal cortex is involved here too.
Yes, the prefrontal cortex plays a key role as well, particularly in evaluating the potential value of different rewards, weighing risks versus benefits, and guiding more complex decisions based on expected outcomes. It helps modulate the more basic drive from the VTA NAC pathway.
And the sources highlight how this network is absolutely central to understanding addiction.
They do, and it's critical. Drugs of abuse are so powerful partly because they essentially hijack this natural reward network.
How so?
They often bypass the natural triggers and directly flood the nucleus accumbens with dopamine or prevent its reuptake, amplifying its effects far beyond what natural rewards typically do. This creates an incredibly intense artificial reward signal that can powerfully overwhelm the brain's learning and motivation systems. Over time, this can drive compulsive drug-seeking behavior and lead to lasting changes in the network's function. Understanding this is just fundamental for developing effective addiction treatments and also for addressing other issues related to motivation and pleasure regulation, like anhedonia and depression.
Wow. We have covered quite a journey today, really peering into the brain's operational teams, haven't we?
We really have. From the default mode network quietly shaping our inner world when we're at rest, to the central executive network taking command for those focused tasks.
The salience network acting as the vigilant filter, deciding what matters.
The attention networks, Dan and Van, managing where our focus actually lands.
The limbic network processing our deepest emotions and memories.
And finally, the reward network driving our motivations and learning. It's quite a cast of characters.
And I think the big takeaway, the thread running through all of this, is that these aren't isolated little boxes in the brain doing their own thing.
Not at all.
They are deeply interconnected, dynamic systems constantly interacting, influencing one another, collectively shaping pretty much everything we think, feel, and do. It's a picture of the brain that's far richer, far more integrated than just mapping individual functions to single spots.
It really is a beautiful dance of coordinated activity, constantly shifting and adapting.
So, thinking about that default mode network again, the one that's so active when we're supposedly at rest, doing nothing, and then considering that fascinating, though cautious, research hinting at its role in altered states of consciousness. What does the mere existence of this fundamental resting network tell us about the baseline state of the human mind? And considering how disrupting it, like with psychedelics, can apparently lead to such profound subjective experiences, how much is still left to uncover about the full range of potential states our consciousness can actually inhabit, perhaps states far beyond what we experience in everyday life?